welcome to another episode of Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and part of the Pitcherlist Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. In this installment, we'll talk about all the small things, the tweaks, adjustments, and adaptations players make, and which matter. But before we get to the good stuff, Alexander, how you doing?
Hey, not too bad, Matt. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well, Coming up on the end of the school year, so that's always very exciting for the teachers. Bidding farewell to this year's kids. Although I teach 7th grade, so I bid them farewell, and then they come back and bug me in the hallway when they're 8th graders next year. But it's a nice place to be because I'm not actually saying goodbye.
Yeah, I remember those days. I remember doing exactly that. This is oddly kind of when things pick up for me. I have a lot of like tutoring and like SAT teaching stuff that's actually getting really busy right now because all the kids aren't as busy anymore.
Yeah, right. So, they've got time. Parents want to keep them busy, want to keep the brains engaged. So well, that's good for you. Business is up.
Yeah, something like that. So I actually had my very first student in my office, like actual in-person teaching experience for a long time. So
how'd that go?
Great. I'm a sort of person who has a very interesting physical energy as a teacher where, you know, I want to be able to write on a whiteboard. Whiteboards are fun.
Yeah.
I want to be able to, like, if I'm blocking out a sentence, throw up a binder in front of a word and be like, okay, how does the sentence change here? And there's some physical comedy to that.
So, yeah, yeah. No, that's
is
good.
That part of your repertoire?
Being in person is definitely, well, I was in person for a lot of this year, but I still couldn't do my normal tricks. So I'm looking forward to a summer where things get much, much better and a fall next year where things can really be back to an actual normal. So I've been physically in the building most of the school year this year, but you know, doing things like group work and hands-on stuff and sharing resources and physical proximity and making sure kids are 6 feet apart and all that is really, it throws a monkey wrench into what you normally do. So it's been maybe more normal than what you've been doing, but that's with air quotes for those of you at home around normal.
Now, the busyness of it all did mean that I actually had to turn down an offer to go to the Orioles game on Sunday when they scored 18 runs. it was also like 95 degrees in a day game on a Sunday. Not my favorite of all different varieties of games to go to, I should say.
Sure. Yeah, super hot. I did a game at Fenway once, and I really felt like I was literally melting into the seat. But you know what? Baseball, it's baseball. It's fun. I'm actually very excited for what we're going to do here with this episode tonight while we're recording tonight. I don't know when you're listening at home. It might be the daytime. So, you know, I don't want to make any assumptions. We're going to throw together an episode here where we're going to talk about some really interesting stuff. This one may wind up being a little bit more regular baseball focused and centric rather than fantasy, but wherever we can kind of come up with actionable, information or takeaways from what we're going to talk about, we will do our best to inject that in, but, follow us to the end on this one. I think this is going to be really, really interesting. So what I want to do to start off, we'll start with the bell ringer and then we'll move through this pretty quickly into the kind of smorgasbord. Is that how you say that? I don't know.
All of the above.
We'll go with cornucopia. There's a cornucopia of things we're going to talk about here. And we'll get to that, to all that. But let's start with talking a little bit about ride. This is a term that's used to describe kind of the velocity as well as spin rate, the perception that a pitch is actually maybe even rising a little bit when it's physically not, or that it's staying a little bit. It looks like it's staying up when it should be dropping. It's more of like an optical illusion. But talk a little bit more about ride because we're going to need this for context when we move into our number of the week.
So I actually want to kind of like shout out some good analysis that I think kind of runs contrary to like some of the data I like that also kind of goes in here. A guy by the name of John Means, you might have heard about him and how he almost but didn't actually throw a perfect game. Yeah. So John Means does not throw the ball exceptionally hard. Mm-hmm. What John Means does do really well, though, with his fastball is he makes the ball spin well. That spin and you know, like air physics basically means that the ball resists dropping a little bit.
Yeah,
basically just kind of like how the air cushions it, you know. It's like, it's, I don't know, plane wings, something like that. I don't know, I didn't like physics. But basically John Means's fastball is consistently above where batters expect it to be. And if you want to know how you successfully become a fly ball or pop out pitcher, it's by having a really exceptional fastball ride. Fastballs move very fast and they don't move that much. So if you can get them timed, you can hit them very far. I think you may know. So a lot of good pitchers,
I can't, they can.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of really good pitchers have a lot of ride on their fastballs, essentially, to kind of like, you know, in addition to making the ball move very quickly and kind of throwing off hitters' timing, they also kind of keep it from being where the batters would expect a standard fastball of that velocity to be.
Yeah.
Which in turn means they swing a little bit below it. And rather than like cranking it into the seats, they crank it into the left fielder's glove comfortably.
Yeah, right. Or shorter, it's less that, right? Sweet spot, less barrel, more just missed it kind of thing. Yeah. So this is important because what I want to talk about with our number of the week, it has to do with ride and spin rate. So here's the number. I'm going to give it to you. It's 2436. And that represents Garrett Cole's average fastball spin rate in his last game, the game that came right after Major League Baseball decided they were going to enforce some more of these foreign substance, sticky substance type of rules. And it was down from 2561, which was the average of the averages of each of the last games that he had pitched on his fastball. This is fastball only, but it was across the board on spin rate on a lot of pitches.
It's down 130 RPM in one game.
For Bauer, just to throw this in for context, because everybody likes to talk about Bauer, and you know, some people say like, you know, he's the hero or the villain of certain stories, and you know, Trevor Bauer the baseball pitcher versus Trevor Bauer the off the field human being. We can flesh that out. There's no need to split those hairs here for this conversation. I bring him up simply because he has talked a lot about spin rate and sticky substances, and so it makes a lot of sense to talk about him. And his spin rate was down 233 RPMs on his fastball in his last start as well. So let's talk a little bit about spin rate, sticky substances, where we're at with all of this. We'll take the conversation wherever it goes. That's fine. But I do want to link it a little bit to ride, because if spin rate is down, that's going to affect ride. So certain players that rely on that, maybe like a John Means, if he happens to be using this sticky stuff, which there's no evidence he is, as an example, if that's his bread and butter and he was, and his spin rate suddenly drops by 200-400, his ride is going to be impacted. He might become more hittable. So there's where the actionable piece kind of comes into it. Anyway, I said a lot of things, so I'm going to stop talking and let you take this in whatever direction you want to go in.
Yeah. So I also want to like throw in a potential other effect you would throw out. People use the sticky stuff to get a feel for the ball. Another thing that was kind of happening with Bauer is that he seemed like he was really struggling with location. One of the things that I think makes the conversation about sticky stuff on baseballs interestingly complicated is that a lot of batters and a lot of pitchers seem to be okay with the idea that you can have a little bit of something that's not too crazy to kind of just make sure that the ball doesn't hit people in the head.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure like most people kind of draw the line there within the sport. Now, mind you, both of us in our long and illustrious Major League Baseball careers really seem to like have an eye into what everyone's saying here. But, you know, Cardinals manager Mike Schilt had like a press conference after a big blow up involving Giovanni Gallegos' hat was confiscated because of potential sticky substances. I know that some people don't love to make the old school Cardinals the good guys in a conversation like this. But, you know, he had some very choice words about how the difference between, like, a little bit of rosin and sunscreen is much different from pine tar. And I don't think he said that in, like, really specific terms. So much as, you know, like, is it possible that maybe he had some sunscreen to protect from melanoma? Really, really funny quotes there. I think that we can, as rational people, kind of, if we're given a reason to discern that's, like, real, maybe decipher between those different things. So, like, you know, if everyone's kind of using a little bit of something sticky to get a consistent grip on the ball, Because, you know, they come out fresh without, like, a whole lot of scuffs or anything to kind of, like,
get your
finger on. I think there's a difference between that if it's been kind of leading to, like, the long-term since the dawn of time results versus the near, like, spitball-level results that you get whenever you have a bunch of pine tar on your fingers and, you know, like, the ball is so tacky that, you know, the joke would be that it just sticks to the bat instead of, you know, going into the bleachers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's been pictures that people have gotten of balls, like, sort of stuck to, like, catcher's equipment and things like that, which are, I mean, it does sort of hint at the fact that this is more than just a little sunscreen to make sure you get a feel. And baseballs are like, treated. They're not straight out of the boxes. There's, like, I think one group of people, they have very specific mud that comes from a very specific place. It's actually pretty interesting. You wouldn't think that a story about mud and baseballs would be interesting, but it actually is. Mm-hmm. And they're, like, pre-treated with all of that to try and give the pitchers and the players a little bit of a feel. It's not just an out-of-the-box baseball. But, you know, like, the big thing that's been coming out is talking about this very specific product called Spider Tack, which, I mean, I guess their marketing is you can put it on your hands and climb a wall like Spider-Man. I'm guessing that's the name. It seems to – I mean, it sounds pretty cool. But I'm not saying that they claim you can do that, but I feel like that's the image they're trying to conjure. If you're going to say it's okay to cheat a little bit, how in the world do you draw a line as to where cheating is acceptable and then cheating's not? Shouldn't there just be an overhaul and take this out of the realm of being unwritten to written so that everybody knows what's acceptable, so that everybody can do what they need to do to get the feel and do the things that everybody's okay with without crossing the line and just make it much clearer instead of this, like, nebulous baseball thing that we seem to always do where it's like, oh, well, that's an unwritten rule that everybody knows, except some people are okay with it and some people aren't. And so now we're going to have this beanball, you know, back and forth war. And we're going to suddenly mid-season change the rules on how we're enforcing things. Like, that's my biggest problem with all of this. I'm actually a very rules-oriented person. Yeah, so, yeah. Like, the idea that people are cheating bothers me on its face, but I'm not in MLB. So if everybody's sort of okay with a certain level of this, then why not just incorporate that in so nobody has to break the rule? Everybody's fine with it, and we actually have an enforceable rule that we can do with consistency instead of, like, this selective enforcement. That's the part that bothers me a lot.
Well, you may, like, think of it this way, right? You know, like, you're a friend who's, like, helping your college friends who are, like, really drunk and 20 years old at a party. you know, like, there's this sort of, like, I've been doing the wrong thing a little bit, maybe, but if we want to make people's lives better version of things is to, like, speak up, call an ambulance, and make sure that someone doesn't, like, die of alcohol poisoning, right?
Sure. This is an awkward example, Alex, but I'm going to follow you down the rabbit hole because that's what friends do.
You know, we kind of accept in a lot of situations here where someone might have been doing the wrong thing a little bit, but, like, as long as you, in the long run, kind of put yourself in a situation where you're doing the right things, a good world is we reward that person. Maybe there are a lot of good laws that have been written recently that basically allow people to, like, not get in trouble for calling 911 in those situations, right? I think the way that you might hear, like, the Cardinals talking about it, it's like, yeah, people might have been breaking the rules, but we need to make sure that the end result here is, you know, that our sport, you know, isn't in a really damaged place because of this stuff. And it's kind of like a hazy thing, but I do think that's, like, one of the most common we're choosing to kind of, like, have an open conversation about, like, the maybe little bits of cheating that are happening that really aren't, at the end of the day, that big of a deal because everyone's kind of doing it. I think that what you're kind of getting at there when you're talking about rules, right, is it bothers you that we exist in a world where a lot of people break them, and so you would just rather recodify the rules so that the people who are doing something that's, like, acceptable to everyone seemingly is, like, not against the rules anymore. Like, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, on a large scale, for, like, a societal place, you can't do that for everything, but this seems like pretty easy, right? Like, here's a substance that is everybody cool with it? All in favor say aye. Yes, you can use this, like a rosin bag,
rosin and sunscreen.
That's been allowed forever, right? So you know, maybe it's Spider Tack. I don't know, maybe they can get a sponsorship. I have no idea, but I guess this just seems like it's a specific enough case where you could just kind of say, all right, here is what a pitcher can use in order to better have a grip, because when you're throwing a ball at 98 miles an hour, you want to make sure you know where it's going. But anything that goes beyond this is going to be punished significantly and severely and harshly, because it's, I mean, I don't know, I guess you could equate this to like a speed limit, right? Like, speed limit's 30. Some cops will pull you over at 42. Some cops will pull you over at 35. Some cops will pull you over at 50. And we just all kind of accept that and live with it. And I get that, that's just kind of the way people live. But this, I don't know, this just feels like, rather than making it another thing in baseball, just a dumb thing that distracts from the on-field product, a dumb thing that gets people arguing. Not that people on Twitter need an excuse to argue, but you know what I mean? It just sort of causes dissent and takes people away from the product and puts a bad taste in people's mouths. Just fix it. Just fix it. It seems like it's a really easy thing to just fix.
Yeah. So I think like the moving parts that make this really difficult aren't all that hard to track down. I think first is like an obvious and probably reasonable mistrust of Major League Baseball's front offices to do the right thing. Like, I recall the "it probably happened before I'm born," let's be honest, Jerry Tarkanian joke. You know, the NCAA is so mad at Kentucky, they're going to give Cleveland State another year of probation, right? That seems like what's happening with the Cardinals. Like, they're really mad at Trevor Bauer for basically telling everyone, hey guys, I'm cheating. Here's what I said a couple years ago. Here are my results following exactly in the way that I said, like, would happen. Mm-hmm. Come and get me, and if not, I'm going to get paid. And they're angry about that. And they're also spineless people, right? You know, you can look in a lot of different directions, and it does not seem as though Manfred wants to police the sport for the most part, except in some really weird places. So, like, you get this place where, like, there's a lot of really petty fighting.
Yeah.
The result, then, it seems like, you know, they're not policing any fair and equitable, and the big guys get punished for doing the thing. Because what's the come back like to the statistical and the blah 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 on field results thing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're leading to a place where it seems like a couple of the super elite guys out there, not a couple of the guys who are barely hanging on, but a couple of the super elite guys, right, are the face of this sort of problem, right?
Yep.
If it's Bauer and Cole, and, you know, realistically probably another couple of guys in that conversation that are doing the really bad thing, that is a different political fight for Manfred to have than if it's David Peterson or,
you know, I guess that just makes it worse for me that, you know, we're going to let it slide more because it's affecting the guys that we want to be the face of the game, especially since they mismanage the face of the game anyway in so many different ways. That's a different discussion, but I don't know. It's kind of like, it just feels like parents who are like, well, my kid's going to do this. And okay, well, kids are kids. Like, well, kids are kids, and they need parents to tell them not to do that. That's how they keep them from growing up to be adults that act like kids. And so like Manfred's in a position of power and influence, and that's his job. Like, do your job. If you don't want to do your job, fine, get out of the way. Let somebody else do it then.
Yeah. I think there's got to be that sort of like really passionate response from a lot of us. Like, reasonably speaking, I find myself often in the position where I just get quite annoyed and just don't want to have the conversation anymore because, you know, the cynicism takes over. But, you know, we're in a place right now. They know something's broken. They probably don't want to admit it here in, you know, like May, in the way that, like, they know that if things really, really hit the fan, like, we're going to have a whole lot of really weird things happen. Like, two of the best pitchers on two of the biggest market teams who are supposed to both be good, Yankees' inability to hit with guys on base side, you know, that creates some serious, serious problems. And you can't dismiss the fact that these are, like, it's sport political. It matters because it will affect how they handle it, right or wrong, right?
But they also let it get here too. There was no need for it to have gotten to this place. This could have been dealt with years and years ago.
Yeah. And I think that when I bring all this up, it's not to excuse it.
Right.
It's
not
to tell us to disregard it. It's just for us to kind of like make predictions about what happens next. you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you invested a lot of draft capital in Bauer, and all of a sudden his spin rate's down 300-400 RPM.
Okay, there we go.
You know, that stinks. And listen, not like fantasy baseball matters as much as like human lives and people's careers and health and all of that. We know that. But that it is frustrating. It is frustrating that suddenly rules are going to, I mean, I guess rules didn't change mid-game, but changing the way you enforce a rule mid-game is this effectively the same thing. Maybe even worse, because people go into it thinking it's one thing and suddenly it's different. I don't know. The whole thing just screams of like disgusting mess that could have easily been proactively dealt with and addressed in a pretty easy and reasonable way and just wasn't. And now it's just gross and everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the questions that kind of spins off from this first order is just like, how am I supposed to be a good fan right now?
Yeah.
How am I supposed to be the sort of person who, don't just tweet mean things that beat reporters. That's a whole separate thing. But, you know, like, how am I supposed to be someone who can kind of just sit on my couch or, you know, sit in like Camden Yards and have a frank discussion with like my friends while we're watching the game? Like, yeah. You know, here's Gerrit Cole striking out, you know, the eighth Oriole of the inning, seemingly. Yeah. And like, how am I supposed to feel about that? Yeah.
A lot of dropped third strikes there. That catcher's going back to AAA.
Gary Sanchez really needs some work, apparently, in this hypothetical. Yeah. But, you know, if we're supposed to be good fans, I think we have to be able to kind of assemble a lot of the information and figure out how, like, the patterns over time tell us to put it together. And the patterns over time tell us that the MLB. Let's also annoy some other people. I like to say that when I say the MLB, I mean Manfred. When I say the MLB, deal with it. You know, we're being realistic about like they have shown us who they are, and it was on us to believe them the first time, and we're on, you know, 30 or 40.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean we have to like it, it doesn't mean we have to, you know, just swallow it. And listen, I know that we can't make everything predictable, and I wouldn't want to, and I know that we can't iron out every wrinkle in the game, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take care of the ones we can, and to have such a blasé attitude about something that seems so readily fixable just screams bad management at that level, and like, yeah, just another example of just a bad job.
Yeah, I think that my role in this discussion is to say that, see that guy over there on the other end of the Zoom call? His anger is justified because of XYZ. And, you know, that's all this is. You know, being smart about baseball means being willing to listen to information that makes reliable prediction. We don't like data because it has numbers. We like data because it tells us about the future reliably, and we're curious about the future. We care about the future. So like this whole sticky stuff, spin rate discussion, you can't have it without understanding how Manfred and Co. kind of operate. You can't understand what's going to happen without knowing how MLB politics happen. And I think that like another part of it that I think is really interesting is you can't have it without understanding that like the impacts of it seem pretty severe right now, in particular, because like hitters kind of suck. Pitchers seem like they're way OP and need to be nerfed, devs, to put that in some real, real great, phraseology. And
some generational
that's like another part
lingo
of
going on there.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not on my parents' health insurance anymore. I don't know if I'm really allowed to say those things. But realistically, like, we sit in this place where it looks like we need to pick a fix for pitchers being too good. I've kind of been in the let's scooch the mound on back a little bit, because I do like to see pitchers move, but I do think that hitters having a little bit more time to like react to them would be nice too. But you know, just making pitchers less disgustingly filthy because they don't all have equal and by the book access to that filthiness is a really like fair seeming way to deal with that.
Right.
That also maybe doesn't come with the shoulder and elbow concerns that people seem to throw out with the move the mound back proposals, which I am willing to listen to, right?
Yeah.
Those injuries concerns being real. So like, all told, there are just so many different reasons to be on board with the idea of fixing this problem by cracking down in some way that's fair and consistent. I think my bias is just to believe that they're going to bungle it again and again. So
you're just fine at each, because it's expected. And managing expectations is important. So if your expectations are managed, then fine. I don't know. It's just the whole idea of I'm just going to let things go and see how things shake out and then shake my finger at it afterwards just is not working.
I'm also not all that powerful in the MLB's like grand scheme of things. I think that's part of it.
Doesn't seem like Manfred is either, so you got that in common.
Maybe we can hope that the collective hatred for Trevor Bauer among his peers will lead to a situation where they're willing to agree to a set of enforceable rules that basically messes with him. His hatred for Gerrit Cole and then everyone else's hatred of him leads to reform. Is that a pathway that we can endorse?
I don't know. I'm also not preaching that I know everything and that every single decision is as easy as it might seem. But I mean, this just seems like it's so specific and so focused that, like, here's one thing you're allowed to use, move on. Anything else is not allowed, and we're just going to totally crack down on it. But we're going to do it at the beginning of a season. We're going to do it clearly. We're going to do it with a press release. We're going to make it clear, not nebulous. Anyway, I'm saying the same things over and over again now. I don't want to keep beating this dead horse. But obviously, I'm not thrilled with the way that they're handling this because I just don't think it's fair, and it creates a situation of unjust enforcement and selective enforcement, which I think is actually worse than the cheating, to be honest.
Yeah. It's pretty clear right now that they want to send a message to the big guys by punishing the little guys. And I don't like that because the little guys, one, are not being paid $50 million a year. Two, are probably way more, in need of that extra little bit of cash because of the way the CBA works. And three, may not even be doing anything nearly as bad. Like the whole thing with the Cardinals, it doesn't even seem like we're dealing with a spider tax situation.
Right. It's not the most egregious violation, but it's the one that's going to get enforced because, well, we're not going to get pitchforks and torches over this guy. But that's a guy with a family probably and a livelihood and a career. I don't know. Anyway,
it sucks that Giovanni Gallegos may need to be worried about a substance potentially that's not even that bad that helps reliably produce his command or
Trevor Bauer is shopping for islands and not getting in trouble for it. I don't know. Yeah. It just doesn't seem
super
fair.
That's the thing that ticks me off. Right? There we go. I think we've narrowed in Bethlehem. The stats sort of stuff of it is kind of like the less important as much as just like let's reason through it and with like a real sense of priority in mind.
Yeah, definitely. And they seem out of whack. All right, let's move into our central question, which, to be fair, is a little bit nebulous. So calling it a central question may be a little oxymoronic in this particular episode, but it's going to be broad, but I think that gives us some flexibility to talk about some really interesting things. So we're going to be kind of looking at how players adapt, tweak, evolve to get an edge, to change the way that they play, to maybe give up something. And this could even be teams and approaches and concepts. We're probably not going to be focusing so much in terms of actual players for case study and more concepts and ideas, although I'm sure players' names will pop up as part of the discussion. Again, this is going to be a little bit more real baseball centric, a little bit less fantasy baseball centric, but if we bring something up that's actionable, we'll certainly hit on that. But I'm going to leave this up to you, Alexander, to take us away here. What's one of the first things that you'd like to talk about in this? What did I decide on? Was it smorgasbord or was it cornucopia? I can't remember. I can say cornucopia better, so we'll stick with that one.
Buffet.
I don't know if buffet in the COVID era might not be good. I don't know if those might be gone forever.
I don't know how I feel about missing out on CC's pizza for the rest of my life.
Your internal organs probably know how they feel.
Yeah. I think the binding glue here between these two conversations, one of which we have not yet cracked open, is kind of like how to be a good fan. And, if we're talking about like how to reasonably interpret information about sticky stuff. The other question I think that has kind of been popping up lately is more about like how the game should be managed. And I really want to take a longer look about how we can use some good statistical tools to evaluate bunting decisions, because it's something that I looked at last year and it's shown up again in a really interesting way. So a couple days ago, the Royals lost a game 2-1 against the Minnesota Twins. That is not all that like important or surprising in and of itself.
But stay tuned.
But what is surprising is that the Royals did this fun thing where they bunted into a triple play.
Yeah.
it was a really incredible play and just a great athletic feat actually by Miguel Sano to kind of like set it all off.
Yeah.
So, you know, to set the stage, we got runners on first and second, and the Royals with no out are calling for a bunt. So what happens is not exactly what we would have expected. Nicky Lopez, the nine hitter, is up to bat. He squares to bunt and he pops it up. I think one of the things, well, this ball is in the story in the air that we need to consider is the fact that when you bunt, there are a lot of really non-good things that can happen.
Yeah.
You can miss the ball. You can bunt it like directly, basically into like the catcher's, I can pick it up and throw to third, like yep. sweet spot.
Yep.
You can bunt it directly to the pitcher very firmly and he can do the same, or you can pop it up in which no one can even advance. And because you're in a bunt situation and everyone's ready to advance, some bad things happen. So the kind of like discussion I want to crack open here is kind of like how we use some more like averaging the past, looking back on the data rather than just on like the historical wisdom to determine what a good managerial call is. You know, to kind of like set off a comparison, it's a little bit different. Like, where did you fall on the whole Blake Snell should have or shouldn't have been pulled out of the World Series game conversation?
I was pretty apathetic to it. I don't. I think that the world of analytics is a very important world. I think that there's a human element to the game as well, and it's not irrelevant simply because we have all of this data. If it was irrelevant, the seasons would be foregone conclusions, right? So somewhere in the in-between statistical analysis and what it brings to the game, there's an intersection with this human piece, and that's the sweet spot, and it's a moving target, and I don't know that anybody is ever going to hit it purposefully or on purpose. That's what everybody's aiming for, right, is this absolutely perfect intersection of managing the people and the numbers. I think anybody who nails it on a given night or over the course of a season does so because they're constantly chasing it. But I don't think it's something that is predictive enough that you can really hit it reliably. And so, you know, I have a hard time getting on any manager for making a decision on either side of that because they have the information we don't have. And sometimes it looks really obvious and bad and maybe dumb, but it also, you know, if he leaves them in and everything goes well, then we have a totally different discussion. And that's happened before too, where, you know, I can't believe he's leaving them in and wow, what a great decision. What a smart move. I don't know. Was it, or was it just kind of like that? It just happened to work out that way. So I don't know. Anyway,
I think what clouds that decision and why I bring it up first on purpose
mm-hmm.
is that we have an incredibly small sample size unlike that, and the error bars are gigantic.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a decision that we can really use the past to like kind of inform our future all that well. Bunting is different.
Yeah.
How many times have we had a runner on second? And, you know, we can figure out basically, especially when you're not towards the end of the games and you're just kind of just figure out like, okay, score as many runs as I can here in the third inning. Or yep, actually, right. I don't know exactly which inning it was that this play took place, but either way, I don't think it changes. Okay. Basically, my belief is that like we can kind of distinguish between bunting in the bottom of the ninth or in extras
yep.
versus bunting all other times.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things that we can do here is use some tools that are called like run expectancy matrices. That sounds really complicated, but basically we have charts and charts and charts and charts and charts of data that tell us what the particular odds of a specific runner scoring like from second with one out, or you know, like if I have a runner on second with like no out, what are my odds of like, or like what is like the average number of runs I'm going to score in total, right? And the way that these work is really straightforward. So I'm going to pull up a couple of some past ones just to give you guys some examples.
Yeah, while you're doing that, I just want to distinguish between two different things. So there's data that shows like if a runner is on second and there's one out, what's the likelihood of that runner scoring in that scenario?
Yes.
And then there's another set of data that talks about if there's a runner on second and nobody out, how many runs will that team generate? Not just from that runner, but also potential runs coming from future at bats in that same inning in that scenario.
And what's really cool, actually, about the way they do these things is that they add up. So that if you have a runner on second and a runner on first and you have no out, the odds of the runner scoring on second and the odds of the runner scoring at first, you know, they'll add up, and that contributes to your, yeah. So you might have all those like, oh, the double plays influence things. In the long run, really not that much. They really don't. We don't have to worry about them all that much to kind of get a pretty clear picture.
Well, I mean, that would factor into the percentage of people that score.
Yeah,
right?
But
within that 35% of people who don't are the people who are eliminated via double play.
Yeah, not as many as you think. And that's kind of the thing is, like, we think about double plays happening a whole lot. They happen a little bit less than you'd suspect. And there's something to be concerned about in clutch situations, but not in the third inning in the same way.
Yeah, so I think that's a good distinction is clutch. Like, I need this one run versus I'm just trying to score as many as possible.
Yes, and I think that's kind of like is a nice way to kind of open up why we care about one versus the other, right? So I'm going to use some numbers here to kind of illustrate this. And I'm going to make some assumptions, and then I'm going to say that they're dumb here in a second. So I just want to like set the stage here. Okay. So you like bunting a little bit, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're getting into a generational thing,
yeah.
But we were talking about this a little before we started recording. I won't take up too much airtime with it, but I do remember bunting being a bigger part of the game. So I guess maybe I have a little bit more of a romantic, nostalgic view of things as part of like my overall, I like small ball baseball.
But runners on base are exciting. I think I've come around on that a whole lot more, that like the home runs are fun at home and the runners on base are fun at the game.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you a data point that's going to make you a little bit happy. So this is from just 2019, which is the last year that Baseball Prospectus is giving us a full season of good data.
It's the last time we had a full season of data to look at.
Yeah. So 60.26% of people who were on second base with no out scored. So that is representative, for example, of like the beginning of an extra inning situation, right? 60% of the time that runner on second scores according to 2019 data. The new ball, blah, blah, blah. Still like the trends should still like be like consistent for people on different bases. We shouldn't have to worry about the ball being dejuiced affecting like the choices here. Third and one out. So you've bunted successfully and gotten the guy over. The guy scores 65% of the time. So there's an additional 5% increase in the chance of the guy scoring if you choose to do this thing, and it works. If you can get your leadoff batter to successfully bunt the runner over.
Which is a huge assumption.
And there we go, right?
Yeah.
Bunting is really hard. I think it was Ben Clemens at FanGraphs. I need to look this up. I'm going to be giving Ben credit just because I think he's cool. Did a really interesting look into how often bunts are actually successful. And you can do the same thing in StatCast a little bit differently if you have the time. But like 50% of the time or so, when someone actually puts their bat out and makes contact and the ball is in the field, you advance a runner. Mm. Like, bunting is not easy.
Yeah.
Like, not only like squaring the ball up and not going foul, but just getting the guy to advance, not easy. Bunting is, I think, taken for granted as something that people can do. And that basically this analysis then says that if you have a guy that you can really trust to bunt, maybe that's better. Now, here's the other side of this, though. You swing away. Does that increase or decrease your dude's odds of scoring? All this is to say, this great situation that's really fun, that is a nice tactical like game for us to play, that are the runners on second situation, which I'm a fan of, say that bunting could be a strategy that could be viable. And if you like bunting, go be a fan of runner on second and extras like me. If you're not in that situation, though, it's laughably stupid. So let's take a look at the other type of data, which is your expected runs by situation. So here we are. We have runner. This is actually first and second with no out. They would expect 1.5 runs to score if you just do your normal thing.
Yeah.
Do you need to manufacture offense in that situation? No. On average, 1.5 runs will score. And yet the Royals
did it.
I think they lined into like an all-time unlucky play that really just like heightens like the stupidity of all this. Like, obviously this isn't how baseball
really
works.
This is the outlier that we like to talk about, right? They're taking something to the extreme to prove the point that is maybe a little less obvious in normal gameplay.
Yeah. In every different way that you slice it, if you are willingly taking on a run to move a batter over, even if you move the batter over,
you mean an out. Expected taking on an out.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. You take on an out to move the batter, move the runners over. Your expected runs go down. So again, I'm just looking here like the standard, only a guy on second versus a no out. That would expect like 1.4 runs, or probably 1.14. That's a big difference.
That is a big difference. Yeah.
Yeah, and then third and one out is 0.95. In other words, you're giving up 0.2 of a run on average.
Yeah.
By making that choice. No, it raises the floor, as we saw with the other data point. 5% more likely that the guy scores, but it decreases the ceiling. And if you're there in the third inning, these run expectancy matrices, they're not fancy saber metrics made up of like garbage. It's literally, here's the history of the game and here's what's happened.
Yeah, right.
And this is still assuming those best case, my bunt doesn't epically fail and I get left with guy on second with one out.
Perhaps. Right, which really reduces that. So
0.7 of a run. That's 0.4 of a run gone, right?
Yeah.
0.4 runs gone.
Right.
Big drop off. So there is very low upside. There is, maybe you're in a situation where like there's some sort of weird shift on for your lefty batter, which there shouldn't be with a guy on second.
Right. That changes the probability of the outcome.
Yeah.
But then you're talking about somebody getting potentially being able
talking
to
about
get
like
on
those like
base,
stealth
right?
bunts where like people aren't expecting the bunt and you
yeah
you've
but
got,
that's
like,
for bunting for a hit. That's not bunting for an out. Right.
Yeah, that's a best case scenario where like the opposing defense is doing something stupid and your lefty batter is able to square a bunt away up the left field line. Like, I actually really love those plays, by the way. That is one of my favorite plays in baseball, is when the guy bunts successfully, because those people are shifted like that because they are expected they're not. And I think it's just delightful. I know that it's not necessarily statistically all that meaningful. And a lot of batters shouldn't even be prepared for it, right? Because like bunting's very hard to do. And bunting up the line's very hard to do, right?
Right.
You may as well just do the thing you already practice all the time. And I think that's kind of like the other side of this is like, you know, people practice hitting.
Yeah.
People don't have many opportunities to bunt that it would be a good idea to. So you probably don't need to practice it, which makes employing it as a strategy all the more kind of silly.
And even when you practice it, you're probably not practicing it against the kind of pitches that are coming in at you in a game situation, right? So what it sounds like, it's there are some situations where it marginally improves the chances that you'll score a run. So the only time that makes sense to do it is when that run has a lot more value than subsequent runs would have. So like in the bottom of the ninth inning where I don't need to score 1.5 runs, one will do
it. Or the bottom of the 10th, bottom of the 11th, right?
Any of those almost like a sudden death, quote unquote, type of situation.
Or maybe you're playing it really safe because you really trust your pitching and you want to score in the top of the 10th, right? I could see that, you know, because you've got Josh Hader coming up.
I think anytime you're in extras, a run scoring, you'd have to look at what the win loss is scoring one run versus zero runs, right? In the top of an inning, right? And I would imagine it probably increases your win probability pretty significantly to just plate a single run in extras, even if you're the visiting team.
Actually, here's a funny thing. So, how many runs should you expect the opposing team to score on average in the top of the 10th? 1.14. That's what the I'm joking here a little bit. But I'm also not, right? So like there's this strategy and counter strategy, and actually I think this is what makes a lot of modern baseball potentially so interesting, is that if we have smart managers making smart moves, you land in these situations where they know that they can do something that we wouldn't expect, but it's a smart decision. We've seen several managers walk the bases loaded with a runner on third, right? Because they know that the only runner that matters is the guy on third. The people that you walk onto second and first don't matter. So Jace Tingler pulled that out in a recent game, and the Padres won, and it was really cool.
Yeah.
Just like, obviously this is the right decision to make. Go do it.
Yeah. But even when it's obviously the right decision, let's say it's 80-20%, right? Like you're going with the 80%. Yeah. There's still always a chance it doesn't work. And that's, I think, where we kind of focus is, oh, what a boneheaded play. Well, it just happened to fall inside the 20% of times that it doesn't work. But that doesn't mean it was dumb. It just means it didn't pan out.
Yeah. And that kind of gets back to that can of worms I wanted to open up here at the beginning, which I think we kind of have really like used all of them on this. I don't know. I'm not going to finish that metaphor. How to be a good fan.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily know that my emotional way of being a fan is always the most productive. There's something about, you know, seeing Rio Ruiz and Hanzo Alberto out there that really just gets me to be a more cynical person. Like, he's not even, like, those guys aren't even on, aren't even like the cause of the problems.
Well, I think they're, you know. I'll say this. If you're abandoning the human element completely to the point that you are right about baseball, but you've sucked all the fun out of it, then what's the point, right? I mean, unless you're getting paid to do that, unless you're making a bunch of money to sit in a room and figure out these stats and feed them to the managers and to the teams, then fine.
Sounds fun to me. Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to a game, you didn't spend $150 or $200 on each ticket and plus parking and hot dogs and all of this stuff to go there and be like, well, I mean, statistically speaking, this is the right, you know, you want to see your team be exciting and fun and engaging. Yeah. So, you know, we're not trying to make this institutional, like cold and disconnected from the humanity of the game. I think that's the fun part of it, right? But I do think that in the context of understanding why something happened, you can be disappointed that your team didn't prevail, but it doesn't also by nature make it a dumb decision just because it didn't work out the way you wanted it to.
Yeah, I think what's important and easy to take away here is when someone makes the wrong decision and it goes poorly, we can talk about it and make fun of them. Or if you're a fan, you can be annoyed and say that they should be fired.
Sure.
And that's how you be a good fan, is you get upset at the right things. Or, you know, when your team has like an 85% chance to win and some fluky thing happens, you just yell a lot. You don't say our team needs to trade everyone. I mean, not seriously. But, you know, you see those guys who are like, you know, I like to joke that there are a lot of people who on Yankees Twitter who like to play all their video games on easy and just don't know what it's like to face any adversity. Because, you know, they'll be calling for like Aaron Judge to be traded. Aaron Judge is playing quite well right now. He does not need to be traded. And that's the sort of stuff where it's like, I want people to be emotional. I just think that like the best version of emotion is one where you're also right. and that means like I just want people to yell and scream about the things that they should be yelling and screaming about that are like, you know, someone did a conventional wisdom that's dumb. I think that's the stuff that like we should be able to team up with, you know, like the more traditional bro fans to like get rid of the stupid in baseball where like your team bungles a situation like that. Cause that's what it is. Like a lot of bunting leads to a lot of bungling, and there are fewer White Sox runs on the board this year than there should be given the level of the talent on that team, despite the fact that they're in first place by a mile.
Yeah. Well, over the course of a season, I mean, if you're talking about 1.14 versus 1.5 runs times 180 games, I mean, that would
That's exactly it, but I get your point. Right?
That presupposes that you're bunting every game and in every situation, right? But I mean, even if you're only
lose a run a week, still meaningful,
right? That over the course of a season, that's a big deal. You know, that's something your pitchers have to overcome. That's something your offense has to generate a different way. It's a negative that doesn't seem to have the risk reward that goes along with it. Now, that being said, my first instinct on this whole bunting is bad thing was actually a pushback, again, because I grew up with a different kind of way of the game being played, and maybe it was just as dumb then. We did talk off air, and I brought this up, and I think we should share it with the people at home as well. I kind of threw out this question, like, okay, so we're looking at 2019 data. That's within the context of the 2019 player and the 2019 team and the 2019 strategy and approach. What if we were to go back in time to the pre-steroid era and look at these? Would those numbers be different? Would those run expectancies be different because they were able to bunt better or they were faster, and so they were able to capitalize more on a bunt than players are today? And you know, you went and took a look at some of this, and what was it that you found?
Yeah, so we do see some really weird things that kind of show up in terms of things being shockingly similar. So the thing that makes a really good comparison is, let's just look at what are the odds that a particular dude will score from a particular base, because that kind of helps us to eliminate a little bit of the fuzz about like people after him and general run environment. Just like, will we be able to plate the guy from second? And if you look at those odds, well, some interesting stuff happens. Hold on a second. I need to make sure I actually grab the correct number here and don't mislead everybody. So what I'm looking at here is actually, it's not perfectly comparable, but it's really close. So we've basically, I've taken Tom Tango's run expectancy data, and it goes from 1950 to 2015. But still, I think that the post-steroid current era kind of like captures like a pretty good modern baseball sort of like thing, even though we're missing a couple of recent years. No out, a runner on second. Average number of runs to score actually is also pretty much the same. Third base, no out. Average number of runs to score, pretty much the same. Right? So if we kind of look at those, it's like it tends to tell us like the game's actually pretty much the same. I'm looking at some of these data, and it's like I was giving some caveats, but actually I'm looking at it more and like we're in a very similar run environment from situational places that we were pre-90s, right? And there are lots of reasons for that. Players today are faster. There might be a bias for fast players that might have previously existed, but today's players are faster, even if they're also stronger. We're just better at finding athletes or better at turning athletes into good baseball players than we used to be. Mm-hmm. That's what good coaching and good scouting have created.
Cynically more willing to sacrifice long-term health for short-term talent. But that can be something maybe we talk about another.
Yeah, yeah. Well, another thing and is like, you know, we want to talk about all these different reasons why guys don't have careers or as long as like it used to be that if you were really good when you were 25, when you were 35, you were probably still good enough to be in the league. But the reality is now is if you're pretty good at 25, the aging curve, you know, everyone's really good.
Right.
And that's why we end up in these sorts of things. It's like, and that means that all of our predisposed, like, here's how things used to be. You know, when I grew up, I heard so much sports talk radio and so much of my parents being like, or my dad telling me like, yeah, you know, like, look at this play with the Royals and Cardinals. Isn't this call stupid? And be like, yes. And that's how my childhood worked for a lot of it. So it's like, you know, a lot of it was kind of experienced secondhand. I grew up with this really funny A-Rod rookie poster in my room, actually. And I think that because of that, you know, a lot of other kids who've enjoyed baseball and basically saw baseball as a thing that you play on Saturdays and that your parents love. You know, like your understanding of the game is very much going to be very modeled after theirs. Who is it that gets really upset when people don't follow the unwritten rules? Eric Hosmer probably had a very similar social understanding of baseball that I did, right? I think that it's really important to understand, though, that like the game and how the people who play it has changed a whole lot, but like in the long run we can still use the same approaches to see that like no, like people being better at bunting or being better at hitting for contact hasn't actually changed this stuff as dramatically as we think it has.
I was very surprised. Would have thought that if you look back to an era where bunting was more prevalent and small ball was more the way of generating runs and things know, like that, you'd see a higher correlation, but it seems to be the same. Because
teams would be more willing to sell out to get that guy in second across the plate. And it turns out that, you know, we're actually in a pretty similar state in terms of the people who are on base being likely to score. And I think, you know, more of them are scoring via the long ball than being scored via, like, singles and stuff like that. But, like, still, I think the problem today is that we just have fewer runners on base because strikeouts have gotten really high. That's the problem. There it is. Let's fix that.
We can start maybe with a really clearly articulated sticky substance rule rather than this nonsense. All right, I want to get to our pass-fail segment, which is going to sadly bring us to the end of this episode, and we'll save our off-the-books for another time. But this is one that's very interesting to me, and I think that I feel differently about it than I expected to going in, but I want to get your take on it. We're seeing a ton of these City Connect uniforms come out. Just released both of the Chicago uniforms, the White Sox first, and then they just recently unveiled the Cubs. Where do you stand on this whole concept and idea?
Okay, so I have kind of like a mixed opinion on this. First and foremost, I actually really like alternate unis. I care deeply about the clothes that people playing sports wear. Let's make it sound as awkward as possible. Yeah, I actually really love seeing cool new unis. So I watch a lot of soccer. Mm-hmm. I watch a lot of basketball, and kind of like the sort of like the unis have looked the same for 20 years vibe does not persist there. And I'm really interested in, like, there are a lot of really cool alt unis in basketball, or like alt kits in soccer. I think what typically they do really well, though, is, you know, they'll have a good conceit, right? And that conceit won't be like outwardly cringy. And it's as simple as that, you know. Like, I think of like the Milwaukee Bucks cream unis, and there's like a particularly like reason why it exists. Mm-hmm. And they have found someone who's good at making it happen and pull it off. Now, who makes those? Nike. Yeah. Who makes a lot of the interesting soccer unis that I really like? I mean, not all of them are Nike. Nike has some really boring soccer kits, actually. But, you know, like, they did a really good job of, like, landing the ship on some great, like, Nigeria soccer kits, but also a lot of just, like, really cool third kits for, like, English and Spanish teams. I think they will produce some really cool alt unis for baseball. The thing that I'm comparing them against in my head, then, is, like, obviously that thing. But I also think about, like, you know those, like, Players Weekend unis where every single team has the same black and or white unis that were just awful?
Yeah.
I am hoping, here's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that this unveiling means that doesn't happen. Mm. And if we don't get those stupid all black, all white unis that are just horrendous, it's a win. Like, straight up.
So it's a win if that happens. Indirectly. Not because these are great, but because it prevents something worse from happening. Yeah.
Now, I think the defend our neighborhood stitching on the Wrigleyville unis are really stupid. And just because it sounds so Mr. Rogers goes to war. I do like the White Sox ones. I'm really interested in seeing what, like, I like the Marlins one.
Yeah.
I'm really interested to see what they can pull off. And I think the thing that I generally believe, though, with baseball is that they need to go for it more.
Yeah.
I hate gray unis. I do not want a single team to wear gray ever again. I just think they're bad. I think teams should have white, and they should have bright colors.
Mm.
And gray is awful. So, I'm not exactly a purist or anything, but that's kind of my belief. I want to see what they can pull off for Atlanta. Atlanta has a whole lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, I just worry that they're going to wind up emphasizing the wrong thing with them, but yeah. You never know.
I think that basically, though, like, people in Atlanta, like, love their sports. So, I mean, like, same thing, like, there's probably a lot of potential that could be tapped for, like, the Phillies. I want to see what they can pull off for them. You know, for teams that have, like, no tradition or no history, or, like, have some cool colors in their color palette and also no tradition or history.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Colorado.
Colorado is the first team that
I'm not fully looking at you, Arizona. You've got some history. But, like, again, I think that there's a lot of interesting potential for a lot of these clubs to have some cool one-off. Maybe not all of the old heads are going to like them, but who cares, unis? And that's what I want them to go for.
Yeah,
I don't like Wrigleyville because it seems like it's taking the wrong direction, but I don't think it's terrible.
Mm, okay, fair enough. I thought I was going to hate them. I thought they were going to be gimmicky and silly, and I've really come around on it. Now, I do fear that it's kind of like MLB's thing to take a cool concept and make it like the dad version, you know, like the hello fellow the kids. Thing. Yeah. The way Tony La Russa looked in the White Sox uni, like, kind of as a symbol of the way that they're going to pull this off or not pull it off. I love the concept. I love them going for it. And I didn't think I was going to. I really didn't. For me, this is a pass. I'm passing on it. Like a pass versus pass fail. Yeah, and I do worry that in some cases it's going to come off a little cringy, but hopefully not so much so that it's abandoned. Because I'm with you. I don't really, you know, as is well documented both in my writing with Pitcher List and here, I am a Red Sox fan. And I love the tradition of the home uniform, and I've always hated their road uniforms. I just don't think they're attractive. And there's so much possibility. They're the red socks. They have these. I love it when they wear the red jerseys. Well,
don't they have a good, like, isn't there like Patriot Day uniform? Yeah, like essentially their City Connect. I thought that was good.
The City Connect one I thought was really cool. It was very off-putting at first when I saw it because of the colors. And then I was like, oh, right, duh. And it made perfect sense. So
I also like the colors. I gotta say. My favorite color combination in like all of sports is like the pink and black and blue Miami Heat like alt unis that the Marlins need to steal from more. Yeah, like those Miami Vice colors with like black as the base. That's what I want.
I don't hate the color scheme that the Sox had. It's just weird to see your team's City Connect jersey be just a complete departure from the team's actual colors. But
yeah, that's normal. More normal in soccer, I will say. And that's kind of like I'm primed for it.
Yeah. So I guess with that context, it makes more sense. But no, I thought I was going to hate it. And I absolutely don't hate it. And I love these kinds of ideas. Now, I'll tell you what I do hate. And this is where the cynic in me is always going to come out. And that I don't think is being done for altruistic purposes. I don't think this is being done to rejuvenate the game. I think this is being done to sell a whole bunch of merch, which I don't love. But you know what? It at the end of the day, if it winds up being something exciting that gets people into you know, wanting to wear this thing to the stadium and go see their team play and root for it, and there's fun to be had, whatever. If something good comes of a kind of a greedy money grab, then so be it. I'm okay with it.
They're all money grabs. I think I just want them to be selling something good. You know, like, I wouldn't be cynical about most other, like, consumer purchases where I don't, like, think about it that way. You know, it's like Diet Coke comes out with some new flavors. Is it a money grab? Yes, sure, they're grabbing money because I buy Diet Coke, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, my favorite local brewery puts out a new beer. Is it a money grab? No, it's just a new beer. I think that whenever, like, you know, there's a new line of unis, if they're good, it's good. If they're bad, we make fun of them and we bully them into taking them off of the internet.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I said, I thought it was going to be super gimmicky and awful, but I've definitely come around, and every time a new one kind of gets released, I'm excited about it. And I like the Cubs one because it's, to me, it's actually a kind of a cool throwback to a different style of jersey for a different era in baseball.
I'm laying my stake as I want to see some interesting NL West unis. You got a team or anyone you want to call out that you're like kind of hopeful for?
Oh, that's,
maybe they get to do a cool one.
That's a great question. I was thinking immediately of Colorado, because they have, there's just so much they could go.
Purple's so nice.
And purple, yeah, their colors are pretty cool, and I think they could do something really like majestic with it.
Also, the Denver Nuggets have a history of great unis. I think there could be something really cool.
Yeah.
There. So I'm agreeing with you. Colorado, and then I mean I love the old Diamondbacks with the purple teal.
The Randy Johnson Diamondbacks.
Yeah. I think that there is a lot of interesting history to dig up properly there that I want them to try. So
yeah,
that's what I'm hoping for.
Well, I also think it's cool that they're kind of revealing them slowly and not just like over a weekend, which is kind of the way they've usually done these sorts of things. Well, anyway, we have come to the end of this episode. We're actually a little over time. That's fine. It's always a fun conversation. I guess it's not overtime if it's always this long. This is just time. So thanks for listening and being along on this ride with us again on this episode 19, Big 2-0. Next week, we're going to be releasing the Big 2-0. Again, thanks for listening. And Alex, if you could just let the people know where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.